Good afternoon. The Open Mind begins its 1961 programs with a subject that is certainly central to American life today, the suburbs. Most of us live in the suburbs, or about to move there, or dream of living there. And all the while, we worry about the suburbs, worry about them endlessly, fret over them, analyze what they're doing to us. Two of the most interesting commentary on life in the suburbs are represented at this table today. Some 5 years ago, Dr. Richard Gordon, a psychiatrist of Englewood, New Jersey, and his wife, Catherine Gordon, a social psychologist, began investigating their own area, their own suburban area, Bergen County, New Jersey. And their findings appear in a forthcoming book entitled Split Level Trap, which is already being read by multitudes of Americans because it's an abridgment of it, is a featured article in this month's Good Housekeeping magazine. Several years ago, Mr. Sloan Wilson appeared with a book which gave a whole phrase to the American language, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, another novel, as we all know, about the suburbs, and now Mr. Wilson is out with a further book on the suburbs, Sense of Values in Them. So our panel today, here to my right, actually, Mr. Sloan Wilson. In the center, Dr. Margaret Mead, a very distinguished and very delightful anthropologist, and across from me, Dr. Richard Gordon. Dr. Gordon, this week when I was talking to one of my colleagues, he asked me, what's the open mind going to solve this week? And I said, stress in the suburbs. And he said, oh, heavens, not that again. Don't you people know that Americans have always been frenetic, status-driven, et cetera, et cetera? We only talk about it more nowadays. You think there's anything in that?
Well, there probably is, but in recent years we've had tools with which to measure some of the stresses that have been prevalent in America, and the studies that Mrs. Gordon and I have done using such instruments as the statistics on divorce and delinquency and coronary disease, coronary artery disease, ulcers, emotional disorders as measured by patients going into mental hospitals and seeking consultations with doctors, that many of these things are some indication of whether there is stress, and we find that certain types of suburbs in which there's been a great deal of mobility, a great deal of people moving in and out, people trying to get ahead in the world at very fast rates, and a great deal of the melting pot, the cultural interaction that takes place in America, but has usually been associated with city life, has moved into the suburbs now in these more rapidly growing communities that have crept up all over America in the last 10 years, and apparently this seems to be related with more stress in these communities around the big cities.
Dr. Mead, I see you smiling. Is that ruefully, or?
No, I was thinking particularly that this point that Americans have always been status-driven that you picked up. I think they're less status-driven today than they were, say, in the 20s.
Not in Dr. Gordon's book Wilson's novel.
No, but you see, in Dr. Gordon's book, he's dealing with the people who got sick. Yeah. Now, and they were status-driven. Now, if you looked at them in the 20s, it would have been the people who didn't have enough ability to move and yet were in the suburbs who probably would have gotten sick. We don't have as good material. We don't have anything like the detail that we have now. But there's been very interesting work done on this country over time to show that the people who move too fast and the people who don't move fast enough are the people that get sick. So our cities used to be filled with pockets of people who couldn't move out, who couldn't go anywhere, where the children were even worse off than the parents. They got sick. These are breeding places of delinquency and crime and every kind of misery, too.
But you're Nathan Bond, Mr. Wilson. He's not sick. He's just miserable. And is he the characteristic product of the suburb, as you're painting him? Is he something new in our life?
Well, this gives me a chance to say something I've wanted to say. I don't think you can just say suburb as a generality. There are all kinds of suburbs.
That's right.
This man, Nathan Bond, could be living on Park Avenue, and he'd be the same Nathan Bond. I think we have suburbs like Levittown, where the income is relatively low compared to Greenwich, Connecticut, and suburbs like that. I think that when we talk about suburbs, we're really talking about the American middle class, upper and lower, and just plain middle. I think that we have to remember that people don't usually acquire sickness when they go to the suburbs. There's nothing inherent in the soil of Darien or New Jersey that is going to make them sick. What sickness is in the suburbs is brought there by the people. And I think, of course, I'm the only non-scientist here. My only qualification is that I was born and brought up in the suburbs. I think that...
You're not calling a historian a scientist now, Mr. Wilson.
Of a kind. More than a novelist.
We thank you.
More than a novelist.
No, but I think if you take, for instance, the cases in Dr. Gordon's book, there's a kind of loneliness in the suburb that is different from the loneliness in the city. Now, you may say loneliness is always a difficult thing to handle, but being lonely in a house on a street, in a street without a sidewalk, as many of our new suburbs are becoming, and not having the familiar drugstore down the corner that you walked down to when you lived in the city, this is a special kind of loneliness. I agree with you that there's nothing indigenous to a suburb that makes people necessarily sick, but there's special kinds of stresses in suburbs that are different from the stresses in the city.
Could I suggest this, that it might be, this loneliness thing might be different for different members of the family? I think that children may be less lonely in the suburbs than in the city. I know that there are blocks where every house has children of about the same age, and they can gather all around the block. I think that perhaps for women, in at least some suburbs, there are many organizations where the women get together, church and social organizations. Perhaps for the men, who very often are divided between city and suburb, the suburb is the loneliest place of all.
You people seem to be agreeing, do I understand you correctly, that modern America, and particularly suburban living, has introduced at least new types of stresses into our life. Is that a fair
suburban
statement?
Living is typical of modern America. The census has shown that the great proportion of new growth in America has taken place in the suburbs in the last 10 years. This is where growth has occurred.
And, of course, there's the other point, that this is a different group of people living in the suburbs. In the 20s, the middle class moved out of the city into the suburbs. And this may have been a way of moving up in the world, and there was a lot of competition and stress of this sort. But these people who are moving to many of the new suburbs today, parents were workers, and they're the first generation of the middle class.
Yeah, that's
and
correct.
So that they don't know how to live as middle-class people anywhere. They've had to learn this. And, of course, this is one of the things about suburbs that we get attacked. It's attacked so much that I think is quite important, that the amount of time that people spend looking at each other's curtains, looking at each other's sofa cushions, worrying about whether the children should or should not do this, they're all trying to learn. They're trying to learn a new kind of life, and nobody knows how to live it in most cases.
Well, isn't this true about many suburbs, that people move out from the city, and they're not just moving to the suburbs, they're moving to a whole new echelon, economic and social level. I know in many suburbs, families change houses every 3 or 4 years within the suburb. They're always moving. It's not just the suburb, it is the fact that there are different parts of the suburb, from one suburb to another. And it's their mobile quality that I think creates the instability.
They do this in the city, too. If you take a city like Detroit, this happens constantly. And people live for 3 or 4 years in a small group. They get attached to a little church. Then they move to the other side of Detroit.
Well, now, Dr. Gordon, is this all you mean when you write a book called Split Level Trap? This is a rather dramatic, extreme term. Or do you mean that there is some new tension in our society which is far more serious than the kind of thing that's being talked about?
No, we don't think that there's anything particularly new. We just think that it's sort of become concentrated in our new...
In the suburbs.
In the faster-growing ones.
Yeah.
We contrast these to the slower-growing ones, where apparently there is less ulcer and less divorce and less delinquency. There's a direct relationship between the speed of growth of many suburbs and their delinquency rate.
I wonder whether we should attribute it all to the suburbs or whether we should attribute some of it to the change in the position of women. Mr. Wilson, let me go back to some injudicious words you wrote in 1956. You're writing about the woman in the gray flannel suit, and you say, "The more I think about it, the more I wonder whether women should be in careers at all." Maybe even in 1956, that protects you a little bit, the place for women is in the home. Is this part of the dislocation, the tension that we're talking
well,
about?
Well, these suburban women are in the home all right. They're just where Mr. Wilson wanted them to be. They're, after having been educated, many of them quite well educated. A town like Levittown has a very high educational level for its, women. And they're taught to think, they're taught to use their heads, they're brought up as if they were going to do something, and then they're put in a suburb, in a house all by themselves, to do all their housework with a whole batch of children. We used to think this was hard on the slum dweller when she had nothing but a couple of rooms that she didn't try to keep clean. The daughters of those people who have had an education are put in a suburb to keep a big house clean and run five children. And these are the ones that get sick. It's not these,
These are the women who are trapped in their split-level house.
The emancipated woman is the woman who ends up trapped.
She's not emancipated.
Well, according to your description,
she's emancipated. No, she was educated.
She was educated to think of herself as emancipated.
No, she was educated to think she might use her mind. She might be a person.
The solution for this woman with five children in a small house in the suburbs, is the solution for that family for her to go out and get a job if she's got five small children?
Well, the solution is, there is no one solution. But part of the solution is recognizing that they're not happy with a good education tied up with their children changing diapers and fixing formulas as their sole contribution to the world's needs.
You see, you've got the father home too now. That's what you accomplish by when you insist on putting the wife in a house like this.
A friend of mine, Charlie Saxon, has a book of cartoons out called Happy, Happy, Happy. And I think maybe we are getting stuck on this phrase, happy. I don't really think people were supposed to be blithesome all the time or that we're going to invent a condition where they're going to be. Do you think that they are less happy in the suburbs? They have and what do you mean by happy? Do you mean
they're getting more ulcers, these housewives who are trapped in their houses.
Happiness is not having an ulcer.
Well, I don't think having an ulcer makes
health
one...
Health means not having an ulcer.
This is not the... we're not striving. I, as a doctor, would prefer to see fewer ulcers in the world. And we can see that there seems to be a relationship between some of these women who are trapped, and not only trapped, but other things happen to them, too. I'm glad that Dr. Mead started this conversation in this direction, because these women not only are trapped in their homes, but if something happens to them, supposing they get bronchitis, supposing they get a bad cold, which can happen to anyone who's exposed to someone who sneezes, and then they get on top of that, they still have to take care of their routine, and there's no one to help them because many of them have been moved thousands of miles away from their family.
Well, that's true. We have two-generation homes rather than three-generation homes.
That's correct. And then, husband is working long hours plus that extra 2 hours of commuting into the city, which is no pleasure because he's got to buck traffic in it, and that's in itself a strain. And drivers do get a lot more illness than people who are not driving as much.
But, you know, in the well-organized suburb, and I think this is important point in your book, that it's a disorganized suburb where these things happen.
And the new suburb is more likely to be disorganized. The fast-growing one hasn't time to organize.
But organized suburb?
Well, an organized suburb is where...
That's horrible. Yeah.
An organized suburb is where there are definite ways of absorbing newcomers. And they
is Princeton an organized suburb?
I should think Princeton probably. Princeton isn't really a suburb. You know, Princeton is a town with a core. And I wouldn't call Princeton a suburb, though there's some people who treat it as such.
Yeah.
And you probably patches around there where people have to clear off the snow on their own sidewalks, I've noticed.
May I interpose and answer the question? Essex and Westchester are more organized, and Nassau and Suffolk are less organized. Yeah.
No. In an organized suburb, there are a good many devices to deal with a newcomer. And when if somebody moves in the house next door, there's somebody to help, somebody to take in some food, somebody to look after the children, somebody to take the children to Sunday school the first week.
This is good. This would send me to Dr. Gordon.
Well, I know. I agree with you.
It would bring your wife home from my office.
His patients are the people that need more togetherness. Now, I think we've got too much.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not in favor of it, but the people that got sick in Dr. Gordon's book would not have gotten so sick if they'd been in a better organized suburb, possibly.
But, of course, the thing that makes the fellow sick or miserable in your books, Mr. Wilson, is not this kind of thing, it seems to me. It's the drive for success, isn't it, as I
well,
read
that,
both
that
of them.
That is true, and I think that part of the suburban dilemma is the great number of people who feel men who feel that they really are men only if they are becoming more and more successful every year. And I think that very often the suburb can be visualized as a kind of shelf of ice. They're afraid that they're slipping from it. They're afraid that they're not going to be able to get ahead or even stay where they are.
Now, do you think this is new in America, or is this the argument?
I think the new thing in America is the number of men who make their whole success the number of children they can produce. And we've really shifted success over to self-replication.
Let me ask Dr. Mead a question, answer to which you will know much better than I. I've often thought that what is sociologically healthy, that is, a nation in which people can progress economically to the level of their ability, is tougher psychologically than a feudal society where you could blame whatever lack of success you had on the system. I think that one of the hard things in this society today is that you see so many people who were brought up with you and whatnot who are much more successful, and there's almost nothing to blame failure on. And as a result, there's a tremendous drive to go ahead and do something. And at the in middle life, when you realize perhaps that you haven't done very much, there's a greater sense of dissatisfaction than if you were living on a feudal farm and said, well, it's the system.
Of course, this great happiness of people who lived in a feudal farm and the happiness of people who live up in the country, this beautiful picture that Dr. Gordon drew about this lovely small town, you know, where everybody helped everybody and everybody's mother came in and looked after the baby and nobody was sick. I think we overdraw these contrasts with other people, just as we think of South Sea Islanders as people are lying under trees eating breadfruit dropping in their mouths, and we don't know how long it takes to cook breadfruit. and we draw all of these pictures to an exaggerated degree. And one of the things that's wrong with America at present is that they're not paying attention to the things that matter in the world. They're pushing away from them every form of world responsibility, and then they're sitting around having ulcers. And one of the reasons they're having ulcers is they're denying a great many of the realities in the world. I think that was much more important.
Dr. Gordon?
Dr. Mead, a while back, you commented on the newcomer, person from immigrant, lower class origins who has risen in the world, who looks at the houses and sees there what we call facades and somehow thinks that may be what it is he's seeking for. Now, the women, of course, have a slightly different twist on the problem than the men do. And we were talking about the women, now we've moved over to the men. And you're a man who is seeking for success, which may be measured in his mind just in dollars. He, too, is seeing a facade. He's not really seeing what are these really important things that life has to offer. And these are not things that you can that are achieved on first glance. They are things that take a great deal of thought. What is best for us individuals and for us as a group? And they take a lot of rethinking, especially in the light of what's happening in the world, in this country and overseas. But
you know, I would say that most people who move to the suburbs move there to give their children a better life.
That's correct.
This is the central reason why they move to suburbs. Now, it's tied up with success, getting out of the slum in many instances, and of course, the thing has gone so fast that you move out of your bad street to go and live with nice people, and you find everybody else in the suburb came from the same kind of street you did. This is very good.
Only from a different part of the country or a different part of the city and bearing with him a different set of values very frequently.
Well, shot through this part of the discussion is this edging toward the question of values in this new area. I noticed, Dr. Gordon, you make one of your points for, let us say, the cure of this situation, that many of the tentative new values that this mobile society has so far developed will have to be re-examined. People will have to study what each value has to offer in serviceable attitudes and ideas. Now, Mr. Wilson, I gather your book has attempted to lay down some values, at least implicitly. Now, this book received some very enthusiastic reviews, but in the spirit of the open mind, I'm going to read a critical review from it. And it says, the values you arrive at in sense of values for the suburbs are a demonstration of your limp moral philosophy that east or west, home is best. It is all warm and moist and dank. Paul Bunyan has given way to a new hero, Mr. Clean. What we have here is Sloan's liniment, very soothing. A suggestion that your values
I can
are
see that reviewer chuckling. What are you asking?
Anything fair in this?
Of course not. Ridiculous.
What the man is arguing is that you're calling for a return to older values, home, motherhood,
yes,
etc.
Yes, except that in the older home, the men didn't spend their time taking care of the children.
Well, this is right. What I really mean. I think I've said a good deal more than that was, I think, one of the newsmen.
It's Newsweek.
Yeah.
Unsigned.
Of course. What I'm trying to say in this is that a man who becomes very tense, as this man did, in building first a military career for himself and then a career in the arts and also in finance, had, through force of circumstances, to just find out what he did care about. And now, these are simple things, I think, what we find we care about. And he found that he did care about his wife, that he did care about his children, and that he did care about the simple, sensual, and intellectual pleasures in life. I don't know what
I'm suggesting,
other than
Mr. Wilson,
the system of ideals he was groping for.
Excuse me, Dr. Mead. What I'm suggesting is that your solution for the values question is to return to older values. Dr. Gordon seems to be to arrive at some new values. Am I wrong in this?
Well, I am not. Ms. Gordon and I don't feel that one just casts out everything that is old.
No.
One carefully examines, we reassess, so to speak, and examine what is more useful, what is more going to be of more individual and general use, and what not.
But you're going to get some new values, as I understand.
Well, there's very little new under the sun.
You wouldn't rewrite the Ten Commandments.
I don't think so. But I might show one of the examples that we use that seemed more reasonable. When a family would come out into their new way of life, frequently they would spend more time concerned about the appearance of their home. We've been kidded a lot about the crabgrass. If they got a bunch of little kids and the kids want to play, it seems sort of silly not to use the lawn that they presumably went into the suburb to let them play on, but to spend their time being concerned about its beauty. Now, beauty is an important value, but children's growth and playing is also an important one. And which should come first? Well, now, an older family whose children are grown up and who are sort of, they will probably take more concern about their rose gardens and their lawns and not be so turning their lawn over to the neighborhood children. And it might be wise for them to get a home with another group of families where the whole neighborhood is more or less of this type. They'll have more in common. While another neighborhood might be of the younger families, and we don't care too much about the what the children do on the lawns, other than a reasonable amount of concern about the appearances.
Dr. Mead, I cut you off, I think.
Well, you see, when Mr. Wilson says, what else is there? I think that when we're living in a period of history that is unique, and where there may not be any people 10 years from now if we don't take some responsibility, to say that the only values there are to discover you love your wife and children and, you know, sitting by a fire and reading a book or looking at a flower, that this is one of the things that is happening. People are turning their backs on all their wider responsibilities and retiring into little domestic nests with as many children as they can shove in with them. And I think a great many people are taking your solution, probably many more than
what is
a
better solution? What are the new values I would include in what I had said as the good things of life? Some intellectual efforts to try to understand world problems, of course.
Well, we need more than understanding of world problems.
Or zest in trying to solve them. But what I'm trying to say, do you have a creed, which is a terrible question to ask anybody? Anyway, admittedly, I think if we're going to reproduce the race, we've got to have children take care of them. And we've got to, if we're going to make any sense out of life...
Racism is in danger at the moment from war, not from the shortage of children. If there's one thing we don't need in the world is any more children at the moment. We've got too many, and we're not taking good care of them. We're asking a mother to look after 5 or 6 children, and she can't bring any one of them up properly as a result. And we've retired into having children as one form of security in the insecure world. Instead of doing anything about the world.
What do you think people should do in suburbs? Do you think little evening groups talking about world affairs are useful?
No, I don't think just talking is useful.
Dr.
I think
Gordon,
I think,
wants to come in here.
I've sort of been... actually, the very thing that you are doing, trying to do something useful in itself, is an important value. And when people put their heads together, they begin to see what is needed, whether it be in a small community or in the larger country or in the world at large, that will do something about diminishing the...
Well, now, Dr. Gordon, I was unpleasant.
...the stresses and strains in the world that are...
Excuse me,
troublesome.
I was unpleasant to Mr. Wilson. Let me be unpleasant to you. You, in technique number 2 for bringing about a change in values, you say Eve Bright noted that many wealthy people were popular and looked up to. What she failed to understand was that it is not usually wealth itself that wins friends and admirers, but the usefulness, the productiveness from which wealth may result. I showed this section to a couple of friends in Princeton, and they said, oh, what rubbish. That is it not true in the suburbs that wealth has its respect?
Yes.
And that merely saying this kind of thing, that one should be productive and try to win respect through productiveness, has nothing to do with a social situation that's developed in America.
The confusion in people's minds is when they begin to think that it's the wealth that they admire. They envy the wealth.
But they don't admire it even if they...
Well, we have some events in our recent American history involving some wealthy families, and I raise the question in all of our minds, which ones do we admire and which ones do we not think so much of?
I don't know. Which families are we talking about? When Charlie Van Doren did what he pleased to make money and gain fame, the polls showed that about 80% of the people thought he had done perfectly right.
I don't think the country admires it.
Well,
I think we admire some of the other families that are doing
useful
things.
Well, but you see,
things.
It's rather contradictory, isn't it? You say here in this section that people do admire wealthy people, but they shouldn't.
We do not say that they shouldn't. We say they should admire the things that produce the wealth, and they should themselves seek to do worthwhile, practical, useful things that will make the world a somewhat...
And you believe that leading the productive life, like, for example, being a university professor, automatically does produce wealth.
Especially if you see to it that you get your recognition and get your salary promotions, use a little tactful self-assertion in the process.
I don't think that wealth alone is really what we look at this country. We exact a great deal from wealthy people who live in small communities.
Mm-hmm.
Once and so often, the banker's wife has to go out and hang up a tablecloth to prove that she's really egalitarian. And we expect a good deal of participation in small towns, the wealthy and in suburbs. The wealthy man or woman that doesn't play any role in the community, I don't think is... They may be heavily envied, and people may want a house like them or a car like them or a fur coat, but they are not the people that are most highly valued.
I think this is true.
And people would say if something bad happened to them, well, so what? But if something bad happens to the real producer in the community, the person who has earned the sense of respect, whether he's wealthy or not, they...
Unfortunately, and... As always, still pursuing values, I must cut off here. For this discussion, thank you, Mr. Sloan Wilson, Dr. Margaret Mead, and Dr. Richard Gordon.
Privilege.